Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of the Pro Basketball Talk podcast here at NBC Sports. I would call it a social distancing edition, but frankly, it's podcasting. It's kind of always socially distanced. So this week, though, look, everybody's talking about Michael Jordan. The Last Dance documentary has us all focused on that because we can't focus on games. I thought we'd bring in the guy who wrote the book on Michael Jordan, literally wrote the book on Michael Jordan. Let's bring in Roland Lazenby. Let's not even waste time. He's written books on Kobe Bryant. He wrote, actually, sneakily, one of my favorites was Jerry West, and he wrote a Michael Jordan book. He's currently working on one on Magic Johnson. Roland, how are you, my man?
I'm doing great, Kurt. I certainly hope you are.
We're happy and healthy and really have ultimately nothing to complain about. And your books have always been just amazing reads, so well-researched, so detailed, and you're getting brought back into this, but you were probably brought back into a lot of the Kobe stuff. You know, with his unfortunate passing, too.
Yes, thank you for saying that, Kurt. Kobe is just, for so many people, just an overwhelming, first a shock, and then just this profound sadness that I think's going to be with us for a long time. I think we'd have had our minds on it more if we hadn't gotten hit with the COVID crisis and all that it requires of each of us just to keep things headed in the right direction. But even in the midst of that, things keep coming around to Kobe, and it's hurtful.
It does. It is. And I think I don't think that there was ever a complete sense of closure there yet. And I'm not sure, you know, how they get there. The NBA did a nice job All-Star weekend, but there's still a lot of healing to go on. And this is kind of the isolation. It's gotta be hard on the family too. It's tough. And then along comes this, like I said, you were working on a Magic Johnson, which I, you know, personally can't wait to read, 'cause he's the guy who for me made me fall in love with basketball. But then suddenly the Jordan documentary comes up, and we're all talking about Michael Jordan again and all the everything with him. I assume you sat down and watched the first couple episodes of The Last Dance?
Oh, yes. It was quite entertaining.
Yeah, I was going to say, what was your impression? It's a difficult, it starts, and you probably run into this with the books, but I think with the documentary as well, you're telling a story with the 97-98 Bulls. It's, you know, sort of like doing a new Batman movie. All right, everybody knows the origin story, right? Like, the story's out there. So how do you make it different and interesting, right?
Yeah, well, I tell you, there's so many angles. It's like a closet full of coat hangers. But I will tell you that I did a book. I was there in the middle of it that season. I did a book called Blood on the Horns that came out in August after that season and broke a lot of those stories. So I just happened to be in the right place at the right time and had gotten to know the right people. And of course, all of my experiences writing about the Bulls were the basis of writing Michael Jordan: The Life that came out in 2014. Right. But just like my Kobe book, doing so much work about the Lakers and spending so much time with him to write a book called Mad Game, the NBA Education of Kobe Bryant when he was a young guy, and then being the field producer for a documentary, Destiny's Child, I spent a lot of time there and really got to know Kobe. And so these aren't just sports stories. This is my life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and you were certainly in the middle of that Bulls for years, right? I mean, you were there. You talked a little about being in the middle of Phil Jackson and Jerry Krause back in mid '90s, right? Like the '90s, which their feud didn't just start, where this documentary started.
No, it was. It's funny. I had to interview Phil Jackson. I'd been hired to write a history of the Bulls, and I had spent a lot of time with Jerry Krause. He had an entire narrative, and it was interesting. And then I went to Phil, and I was going to get about 10 minutes with Phil, maybe 5 minutes, he did. And I just happened to ask, I really thought about the right question to, and he got so excited, he almost jumped like a bass hitting a line. And he talked for 2 hours to me. I went through every cassette tape I had, my recorder. And he, this was in 94 at the Chicago pre-draft camp.
Yeah.
And he lit up Jerry Krause, who was his boss. And nobody knew back then, they didn't get along. He said all this stuff I couldn't believe. And so I typed it up and I said, before I show this, I showed things to people to make sure they like their comments. And I said, I'm going to show this to Phil and see if he still wants to say all of this. And I wrote up this, it was a 2 hour interview. You know how those things are.
Yeah.
And I wrote it all up and I had described Krause as 5'8", 240 pounds. And the only thing Phil changed in the whole thing, he marked out 240 and changed it to 260. When Krause read that, what those comments he made, he had called Phil into his office. They were already fighting over money behind the scenes. And Krause was furious that Phil had an agent. Back then, coaches didn't have agents. And Krause said, we're going to make sure that when we hire another coach, he's not going to have an agent, which is absolutely ridiculous, of course. But it was like gas in the coal mine. And, I spent the next 4 years with the Bulls, writing their various championship stories. I was there for Michael's return. It was so much fun to watch all those teams. But the gas kept building up in the coal mine. And the anger, there was one thing after another. And man, then I got word about what happened during the 97 playoffs. Nobody knew this, but Krause insisted on riding on the team bus with the team, and Phil kept telling him not to do it. And Michael Jordan and Scotty, Phil was angry over money, Scotty was angry over money, Michael Jordan was angry all the way back to his foot injury, and Phil for that season was just taking his anger and theirs and getting ready to use it to drive that team. That summer in 97, Krause wanted to trade Pippen to get rid of Phil and move on. And Reinsdorf wouldn't let him do it. He knew that would be just ridiculous to do that. But what had happened is during the 97 playoffs, Krause would insist on getting on the team bus, and Michael, Scotty, those guys sit in the back. They'd have a few beers, smoking cigars. And then Michael would start in just on Krause sitting at the front of the bus and things like, Jerry Krause, let's go fishing, Jerry Krause. Don't worry if we don't catch anything. You can just eat the bait yourself. And this stuff was going on and on. And the team was laughing, and it was just, Phil was there going like, I got to tell Michael later on not to do this stuff. Phil was, he really had fed the beast, and now the beast was feasting, and it was basically out of control. And Krause, with his history of being this short guy who had probably been bullied, Krause was a pretty good bully himself, we should say. And
yeah,
my guidance through all of this as it unfolded was Tex Winter, my dear friend, and Tex owed everything to Krause, who brought him to Chicago after Tex had retired from college basketball. And Phil Jackson, Tex was very loyal to Phil, and Phil owed Krause everything. And I would go to Tex and I would say, how do we sort all this conflict out? And Tex would say, well, you know, Phil spent years bending over backward to accommodate Jerry Krause's difficult personality. And when it came to the contract negotiations and the way Krause was acting, Phil just got fed up with it. He's not bending over backward anymore. And, you know, Tex is a guy who didn't have a lot of malice in his heart, so I sort of used him as my referee in trying to sort out my own interpretations of all this madness. And boy, it really exploded, of course, when the season started. Krause had wanted him gone, and, you know, he had made the statement, I don't care if we go 82-0, Phil's not coming back. And the gauntlet was thrown down. And at media day, Krause had made his comments and had gone upstairs to his office, and all the media were down there, and he came back down and he said, you know, he made his comment. He said somebody left out a word or two, but he said, players don't win championships, organizations do. And he said, well, I was misquoted. I said, players alone. Who knows? Who cares? I mean, except for this, it set them off on this very sad and stupid path to shortcutting the tenure of probably, arguably, pro basketball's greatest team.
Yeah.
And it just was a game of chicken to the end, until Phil ended it by, quote, riding off into the sunset.
Krause is a complex character, right? Like he did. I mean, and they got into this a little bit, and I thought Steve Kerr had, in the documentary, I think it was the second episode, had said, like, he deserves some credit. I mean, he found Scottie Pippen and drafted him. He brought in Horace Grant. He did for a guy without much of a basketball background, did a really nice job of building a basketball team, but he couldn't get out of his own way.
Oh, that's exactly right. Krause was a very fine scout. He'd been a baseball scout. It was a little bit like Moneyball. When I would talk to Krause about scouting, he would say, you know, you could just tell from the shape of Kirk Gibson's face he was going to be a great baseball player. That's totally ridiculous. But, you know, that's sort of the showdown between today, the analytics guys and the scouts. But Krause had been everywhere. He fell in love with Phil Jackson as a college player at the University of North Dakota. He wanted to draft Phil for the Baltimore Bullets. He thought he was another Bill Bradley of sorts in his intelligence and whatnot. And the Knicks drafted him first, but he was the only one. Phil had written that book after the 73 Knicks championship for Playboy Press, where he talked about doing LSD on the beach in L.A. and all the kind of stuff that just virtually assured, even though he'd had this good career in the NBA and had played some at the Nets and then became a Nets broadcaster, no way anyone was going to hire him to coach, but no one way anyone was going to get Tex Winter or do a number of the other moves that Krause made. But Krause was also deranged with anger. And he would say, you know, I don't want to chase Michael out the door, but I'm eager for the day when Michael's gone and I can show that I have, that I've rebuilt and we're winning more championships. And I'm going to myself and I had to spend hours with him, frankly. And I'm going to myself, this guy is a loon.
Yeah. I think everybody grasped how great a player Jordan was, but I think even the quote unquote Moneyball guys, your Daryl Morey and what have you in the NBA today, realized that, I mean, Morey, for all the money ball in the world, is a big game hunter who goes and tries to get stars. The guys have come to realize if you don't have one of those top 10, give or take, you know, those elite players, you can't win. And it almost felt like Krause felt like he thought he could go find those guys.
Yes, he later discovered he could not.
Yeah.
And Krauss had, of course, a great belief in his ability. You know, that fall began after the 82-0 comment that Phil's not coming back. And I was doing these one-on-one, on-the-record interviews recorded with Phil in his office. And he knew I was writing this book and that, like I usually did, I was going to let people see things. And he really wanted to poke the bear. And he started telling me, he said, yeah, Jerry just insists on always being around the team. The last thing Michael likes to do before he takes the floor, he likes to go back and sit on the john all by his lonesome in peace and, you know, do his thing. And he says, Jerry always insists out of his need for whatever, you know, his need for companionship, Jerry always chooses those moments to go back there and sit on the john too. And it just infuriates Michael. And I try to tell Jerry not to do these things. And I'm sitting there listening to Phil tell all this stuff. And he had every kind of way to slice and dice Jerry Krauss. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, this is some weird stuff here. And sure enough, when I had was working on the first draft of Blood on the Horns, I let Krauss and Reinsdorf look at it. And I let Phil and all, you know, all different principals look at it. And Krauss and Reinsdorf went ballistic. And they came up with all of this, all this really bad stuff that Phil had done, really low stuff. And so it became a free-for-all. And those feelings were so hard. You know, Krauss told me a few years before he died, about a year before he died, I've got all those tapes of all those championships, all those games right here in my house. I've never looked at one of them. The bitterness was tremendous.
That is incredible that he carried it like that he had that kind of hatred. I'm not even sure if that's the word, but I'll go with it. In his heart too, it's that he was driven like that by this, that the egos were that big. It's kind of, I guess that kind of starts to come through in the documentary, but you get the sense that he just, like you said, he was so driven by that he couldn't get it, you know, for all the good things he did, he couldn't get out of his own way either. So,
right. You know, the unsung hero of this documentary is Andy Thompson, Clay's uncle. And Andy was shooting all this footage for NBA Entertainment.
Yeah.
Andy was the champion. And, you know, he was everywhere. And we would talk about things going on. He interviewed me a couple of times. And, I mean, you just knew he had behind the scenes total access because he was working for NBA Entertainment. And I would see him over the years. I would say, Andy, is your film ever going to get released? I'd see him at the NBA Finals or the All-Star Game or some event in an NBA locker room. He'd go, I don't know, man. He said, Michael will not turn it loose. And it went on and on. And finally, about 2 years ago, ESPN and its broadcast partners came up with $20 million. I don't think it had a thing to do with the money. But the fact is that when that money was paid, Jordan agreed to let the thing go forward. He had control over it. And so it has, they added a director and put it together. And now we have coronavirus. We are all sort of sitting in our abodes, fearful. Mm-hmm. And so we get to spend every Sunday night with MJ and the 98 Bulls. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a comprehensive story of Michael's life, but I can't wait to see more and more and more of the footage that Andy directed in 1997-98. It's going to be impressive.
You talk too about Jordan releasing the rights and the $20 million, which, look, let's not kid, that's a lot of money, but for Jordan, you know, it's not going to change his life dramatically one way or the other kind of
he's
money.
He's a billionaire.
Yeah, exactly. It's too, you know, a lot of people talked about this now being, and I know Ramona wrote about this, that, hey, LeBron wins a title and suddenly he's willing to do this, but he's not only just willing to release this footage to kind of get into the GOAT argument, but it's LeBron is the media guy, right? He is the guy with the media empire, and he's the guy who, you know, is making movies and documentaries. And I work for NBC, so I suppose I should promote The Wall in here somewhere. But he's got the broadcast company, and Jordan kind of comes at him now with this documentary in his own wheelhouse, in his own medium for the GOAT argument. It's vintage Jordan competitiveness.
Yeah, I just have to interject that I have a lot of respect for LeBron James.
Oh, yeah.
He has really done a lot of things as a player. He's very impressive. I don't get into an argument on who's the greatest. I'm a writer. I'm not going to put my two cents on that one. I think I've seen a lot of greatness in my years covering basketball. The last thing I'm going to do is insult a Michael Jordan or a Kobe Bryant or a LeBron James. Those guys laid their hearts on the line night after night after night. Everything each of them did stands unto itself, perfectly clear for all of us. And so I don't get engaged in that part of it. I do believe that the first two segments of this film showed the absolutely irrational, bullying, fierce, uncompromising nature of Jordan's competitiveness. And it's something to behold. Because he could be really, I had to ask him about this and doing Blood on the Horns. All of this stuff was coming out behind the scenes. He didn't look good in a lot of the way he was treating Krause. He really was a bully. Krause was a bully himself, it's true. But Michael was, it was really classic bullying. And so I had to couch the terms because I'd worked hard to get these one-on-ones with Jordan, you know. I'm a guy out here doing books. I'm not working for some big media corporation. I don't have the power of an ESPN or, of that kind of thing. I'm out there sort of with grins doing this stuff, getting these interviews. And it's always tricky because you got to have some kind of power base with you. And so I had to work very hard to get my one-on-ones with Jordan. And I had to figure how I was going to get him to start talking about all of his bullying and stuff. And one of the points of the book, Blood on the Horns, is that Jordan was so fierce, everybody, including Jerry Krause in that organization, had spent years, including Phil Jackson. Tex Winter talked about how intimidated he was by Jordan's persona when he first saw him as a young player there. And they all his teammates, everybody in that organization, even Reinsdorf himself, they were all trying to please Michael. He had that power. And he used that wicked, nasty, bullying sense of humor on a lot of people. It was really awkward when he would get on that bus and bully the team's GM. People would be laughing, but it got very uncomfortable. And I had to ask Michael about that. And I thought, whoa, here I am, pretty much a media nobody, some guy writing a book. And I've got to sit down face to face with MJ and call him out on this stuff. I was, I said, I've got to think this through. And so I decided to compliment him on his team leadership. And I said, man, you use that wicked sense of humor. You are punishing people around you, but you are keeping everybody in line and driving them. And of course, as the first part of this documentary showed, Scottie Pippen was angry and absent. And that Scottie was the one guy who could really take a lot of pressure off of Michael. But now the pressure was full on Michael in this 97-98 season, and he's all over everybody. He's crawling everybody. They got to be just right. And he looked at me and said, yeah, it's true. I can be hard. But he said, I've got to put everybody through the stress test. to find out, particularly the players, to find out if, when they get on that floor with me, if they can handle that kind of stuff, how, you know, how tough they are, how focused they are. And so he went on to address it. I think the behavior, though, over time, stands as its own fact about who Jordan was. To his credit, he controls this documentary. It'll be interesting to see. He's already given us a peek at it.
Yeah.
We've seen his harshness. And to his credit, although he controls it, now he wouldn't want to get into all the things I got into in my book, the biography, Michael Jordan, the life. That's not going to happen. But I admire the frankness of this series so far.
Yeah. You get into a lot, actually, in that book about him growing up and that competitiveness, what, you know, instilled in him from a young age. But, like, he came from a long line of, we'll just call it a hard family, right? Like, this was a family that was tough and competitive and working hard and grinding at a, going back generations.
Oh, no question, on both sides. And the lord of the family was Michael's great-grandfather, Dawson Jordan, and Michael lived with him until he was about 6 or 7. Dawson Jordan was 5'5 and crippled, and he was a sharecropper. You know, he's out following that plow crippled. By the time he's old, obviously, he's in tremendous pain with that crippled leg. But he's also a moonshiner. Now, all of the sharecroppers down on the coastal plain of North Carolina, white or black, were moonshiners because that was their cash crop. And they could never know how they were going to get cheated sharecropping. You know, the guy they're farming shares for can come up at the end of the growing season and say, oh, we had a bad year. There's nothing for you. And it was next to slavery. And so they were moonshiners out of practicality. But Dawson Jordan lived this long life. He was worshipped. When I asked Michael about him down in Charlotte at a game one night, a tear, you know, sort of started down Michael's cheek just stopping to think about Dawson Jordan. You know, he had a wagon with a mule, and the mule and all of the accoutrements of sharecropping, I always equated those things with NBA championship trophies. And I know that seems ridiculous, but the great difficulty, the impossibility, the denigration, and the whole violent suppression of African Americans through the caste system, they required things of people that should never be required of anyone. And so, you know, they used to joke about the hogs he kept, the grandsons did, Michael and his brothers, or the mule and the little cart. And he had the wheels on his cart wrapped in cloth, so that when he made his moonshine runs at night, he would travel silently, Dawson Jordan would. But I equate those things with championships won today. And of course, the championships, as difficult as they are, they cannot touch the degree of difficulty of those great people. Now, Old Man Peoples, as they called him, Dolores Jordan's father, he was not a nice guy. And nobody made any money at sharecropping. This is on the other side of the family, white or black. Nobody really ever got ahead at sharecropping. But her father was so industrious, had so many things going. You know, in that sharecropping era, the houses were just tar shacks, no plumbing. That's why the death rate, the health rate was so terrible. But Old Man Peoples came to own his own land. He also worked a full-time job, but he built wealth. And I wrote the Jordan story as a Black Power story because that's what this is. And, it didn't begin just with Michael. It began with the fierceness of those people, those sharecroppers facing impossible conditions to deal with life. And it really is a story of generations. It's my belief none of this stuff happens in a vacuum, that Michael's fierceness is a product of his grandfather's fierceness. And this Black Power story, my book also details how Jim Crow laws, they had the big Wilmington riot where the white militias came in and murdered who knows how many blacks. Wilmington in 1898 had a couple of black newspapers. It had a Blacksville City Council, black mayor. It had a thriving black business community. And they came in a riot, the militias did, and wiped all that out. There were thousands upon thousands of black male registered voters on the coastal plain of North Carolina in 1898. Within 3 years, there were only a few. There were only three. The Jordans lived for a good while in Duplin County, and I interviewed one of the three left in Duplin County. He had been a sharecropper with the Jordans. And all of this was based on violent suppression. Everybody wanted to make a big deal out of Jordan avoiding the political conversation when he was a young man. That political conversation was not available to black North Carolinians for the longest time. It was just ingrained. Now, on the other hand, Jordan's answer, which outraged many people, understandably, when he declined to get involved in the Senate race down there, he said, Republicans buy shoes too. And that just reflects that there was no black power as far as politics in North Carolina for just about all of the 20th century. And it, Jordan's family was steeped in that caste system. Of course, later, as a mature man, Jordan got involved in politics and has done well for himself. But it was just not realistic for him to jump out there in his youth and step into the fray like that. That was not his cultural background.
That all evolves into his parents, which in the Jordan the Life you get into and describe them as, you could have described them as helicopter parents, which back in the 70s, did not happen, right? Like in the 70s when, that's a little before my era, but even then, like I grew up, you know, playing at my friend's house down the street. My parents didn't know where I was all the time. His parents were not like that.
Right. And, they had their diversions. For a while, James Jordan owned a bar, a nightclub. Yeah. During the childhood, but they were there, they were supportive of James Jordan. On the baseball team, James Jordan loved baseball, played community baseball, sort of semi-pro ball. That was his great hope. And this is the other part of the Jordan story that's basically unknown. But, the baseball was a white sport. The two black kids that were on the team, one of them was Michael Jordan in the year when he was first playing a Little League. That was the first time the coach that I interviewed, Dick Nair, it's the first time he had had black players in forever. And James Jordan would move in. He built a dugout. He was just that kind of guy. He had a job at the GE plant. He had a lot going on, James Jordan did. He was a sharp guy. And so he was there. He just loved baseball. And Michael came along, and it was just like, as one of the Jordan cousins, a distant cousin, explained, it was like watching a young Bob Gibson. Jordan was in Little League, was this blazing pitcher. He threw a couple of no-hitters. He was quite the thing in 12-year-old baseball. And he took his team from Wilmington within an eyelash of the Little League World Series. He lost in a finals game, regional finals, in Georgia, in which he hit a 240-foot home run. He hit that home run to tie the game, and they lost. But the next year, when it went to Dixie League, the base paths got longer. And Jordan had been disrespected by James Jordan, disrespected is how Michael probably looked at it. His father, you know, didn't think much of him. Michael had a brother who was much stronger than he was, Larry.
Right.
11 months older. They battled all the time, but Larry was mechanically inclined like his father, and there was James just had open favoritism and would really chide Michael a lot as a little kid. And I explained that's sort of where the nuclear reactor of Jordan's competitive nature took off. And so the fact that Michael had this tremendous success in baseball, and for the first time he had his father. I mean, his father would brag about that home run for years.
Does that tie back?
And he went up to the next league. The base paths were longer. He was in a new league, the Dixie League or the Babe Ruth League, I forget which. He couldn't get off the bench. He never was even, he was the Little League Player of the Year in North Carolina as a 12-year-old. He never made so much as all district in high school baseball or any kind of all-star team in that next level playing. And from what we know about Michael Jordan's personality, how bad he wanted to be that good, you can just imagine what that did to him. And that fed into his anger over not being elevated to the varsity for his sophomore year at Laney High School on the basketball team. And all of this is the hardwiring of the Michael Jordan that the entire globe is watching this series. As soon as it ended Monday night, I had to jump on coast to coast in Australia.
Oh, wow.
To go over it. And the number of foreign interviews and things of that nature that come along, make no mistake. And of course, my Jordan book's in 15 or 16 languages. Make no mistake, this is a global matter, this guy's competitive nature. Because we know nobody gives a crap who I am, and half of them, 99 9/10% have never heard of me. They're not selling those books because my name's on the front. It has nothing to do with me. They are fascinated with this dude.
That competitiveness for baseball, that's what ultimately kind of drove him back there, right? After his father's death. I mean, I know there's all the popular gambling rumors and all that stuff, but it was it really just a combination of a little burnout with basketball or was it dad driven? I mean, what pushed that move?
Oh, he was deeply, he was in full grief. He came back with tremendous anger out of all of that when he came back. He was already an angry guy, but he came back in the fall of 95. He came back that spring with a fair amount of anger, but he really had it after they, you know, he made a mistake against Orlando and they lost in the playoffs in 95, that fall in training camp. But he was there mourning his father. He'd sit out on his deck at night down there talking to his dad down in Birmingham, where he's playing at the Birmingham Barons. Just about every part of that experience was about that. And I do have to say about gambling, you know, I've interviewed all the old timers. I've written years ago the official NBA Finals history. The NBA is a gambling league. They gambled on trains when they all traveled on trains before they gambled on planes. They gambled on every sort of thing you can imagine. There are allegations of certain Hall of Famers throwing games. I've listened to those in interviews. But nowhere at any time has Michael Jordan ever faced the allegation that he committed the illegal sin. You can gamble on whatever you want. They gamble on golf or whatever. They don't. The league doesn't like the PR of it, but they're. Let's be clear. Michael Jordan has never been accused by anyone of gambling on a game. And so if he didn't gamble on a game, then he did not get suspended. Yes, he had those allegations over gambling on golf, and the league didn't like it. And they had an investigation. But let's look at the facts, and I'm just looking at where I was. He came back. The Bulls were playing games in Vegas in the preseason. I was there with them. If Michael Jordan had been suspended for gambling, do you think they would have turned around and put him in the land of casinos? Do you think they would have ever approved of him in their interior council way of being a part owner of the Charlotte Bobcats? And then the biggest thing, when he was ready to become a full owner in the league and they were making the decision at the All-Star game that weekend in Las Vegas, Jordan was right there waiting for their approval, shooting craps with Pac-Man Jones. He lost $1 million to Pac-Man Jones. Pac-Man Jones explained all this personally to me in a recorded interview himself. He went on, Michael, to lose $5 million that night. Pac-Man went off down to a club to make it rain, which led to the shooting incident, which created the lawsuits against Pac-Man. It was this terrible night. But the NBA knew that Michael Jordan had never bet on basketball NBA games or college games. And so he was not going to be suspended. He was the cash cow that made them all successful.
To go back to the return from baseball, was there a difference between pre-baseball Jordan and post-baseball Jordan in locker room or in demeanor?
You know, I think there was a difference in the league, and it was starting to happen. It wasn't. It really. The NBA started to get crazy in terms of its media relations around 2000, and it has proceeded to get tighter and tighter. And
oh yeah,
it's the All-Star game used to be a wonderful thing, and in his early days with the Bulls. I was not there then, but I've done so many interviews with media personalities, and he was just a laid-back kid. You know, he had that running ping pong game with Lacey Banks, the great writer, the late great writer at the Sun-Times. He had interaction of all sort. He was just young and open to the world and deeply caring about what he was doing. When he came back, I was the benefit still of his openness. It was a huge crowd by the time he was back. The difference between the Bulls in 93 and 94 when I was doing work about them, and then when Jordan blew it up that spring and the insanity of all the international camera crews, and I had to really sort of stalk in and out. You know, I remember in Toronto, I had studied the pattern enough. I knew that the post-game shower, that Pippen would come out first. And sure enough, that night, Pippen walked out and the whole moths to a flame. All the media people immediately were just locked in on him, oblivious to the rest of the world. And it wouldn't be 30 seconds later, here comes Jordan. And nobody sees him. And so I would wait for Jordan. Tex Winter had talked to me all the time about what was going on with the team. And so I was able to actually get these atomizer bullets of questions. And I could ask Michael one as we walked across the locker room. And he would look at me when I asked the question. You know, you'd get that look when you ask a question and somebody's going, oh, wait a second, this this is going to be something that I'll have to think about in
history.
And it built from that. You know, I would get a little time before a game in Dallas one night. I remember sitting with him in Charlotte for about 30 minutes before a game. Things you would never get. He gave me an hour or so alone outside of practice again. And so after the fact, you could get Jordan, but many nights, you know, they call it the pig. I won't use the F word here, but in Chicago, they called all the media scrum around Jordan. In fact, that's how I wrote my am I allowed to say the F word on this podcast?
Sure. Why not?
So my book proposal was the pig fuck. And it showed the scene of Jordan, you know, the PR people would beg him. He'd be in these really expensive suits. All these sweating reporters should be around him. He just played a game. And the media people would say, why don't you do it at the podium? He loved being in the middle of a pig fuck. He loved being in the middle of a scrum. It was a very visceral, personal thing with Jordan. He fed off of that. It was obvious. And so that was part of the dynamic that led Little Brown to purchase my book. But it sort of explained Jordan had this charisma. And people who have charisma, they, you know, he didn't understand this in high school. And it took him time to understand it, even at North Carolina. But boy, he understood it in Chicago. And people who have that sort of charisma, it's one of their gifts, and they love to deploy it. And Michael Jordan loved deploying that gift, and he liked to be right there in the scrum. And that, I remember going to cover him in Washington, and by then he was totally handled. He had PR people around him. You weren't going to get that one-on-one moment. You really weren't going to get a chance much. Unless you were a big, powerful media corporation, and then that would be strained through the system. You really weren't going to get that chance at some truth with Michael. The NBA had begun managing everything. And guys like me, you know, these guys hanging around, I made my living telling the stories in between the broadcasts, you know. I wasn't the best credentialed guy in the world. You know, I've always sort of been an independent. And I was the guy who reported that Phil Jackson had kicked Jerry West out of the locker room. I did that in a Chicago Sun-Times story. And those were a lot of fun days when you could have a real shot at reporting some of the gritty side. It's still done. We have amazing reporters today.
Yeah.
But those were fun days for me.
Yeah, it's different. I will say that this is one of the similarities now to when you talk about LeBron and Jordan. There is a crush around LeBron in Los Angeles after every game, national, international media. He doesn't go to a podium. He does every post-game interview, often sitting with his feet in an ice bucket, you know, with 30 people deep around him. It is useless to try to get into the scrum around him. He does that same thing. And I think it's a little bit of liking that, you know, the charisma thing. I also think it's an exercise of power. This is where I want to do it. I don't want to mess with my routine. I'm going to do this here. And the Lakers have a whole system set up to make sure that the regular beat reporters and the people from the major media outlets are able to at least get close enough to get the quotes. Because unless you make a point of getting in at the front of that scrum, you are going to get nothing. And it does become a chance to occasionally you can get somebody else. It's a lot more guarded than it used to be. There's a lot more media people, but you can, hey, you know, there are other people in that locker room who are fascinating and interesting. And it's besides just Jared Dudley, you could go grab on the side.
And the other thing is I had proprietary information. I had all this stuff I needed to ask Jordan. I wasn't going to walk in there in front of the world and start asking him stuff.
Exactly.
That's going to tip off. You know, you're trying to preserve the value of the information. In this case, I was being paid by a book publisher to be there. If I threw all of that away in the media scrum, I wouldn't be living up to my obligation to the book publisher. And every reporter faces that.
Yep.
And so those things are fascinating conversations. And they are the group story for the narrative of the moment. But we both know, everybody engaged in the media knows, there's so much more going on.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we had just come into the big age of television for the NBA. Magic and Larry sort of got it going. But boy, as Michael told me once, timing is everything. And his timing was he ushered in a global fascination with pro basketball.
Yep.
And it suddenly the reporter's job, everything was there on camera to see as far as the game. But it was suddenly became the reporter's job, I felt, to provide all the context you could to explain who they were. It was sort of like if we were all covering Oz, you know, and that you have the Oz show going on, but then you have the guy behind the curtain. And so for pro basketball writers and media people, well, the league itself began selling a peek behind the curtain. And all of that stuff kept going.
Yeah, it's the
nature of it.
Yeah, and it's evolved so much over time how that's gone. Roland, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this, man. This is great. I think we're all looking forward to watching the rest of this stuff. And if Blood on the Horns is a fantastic book. You talked a lot about that. Michael Jordan, The Life, is a fantastic read. I mean, all of your, like I said, I love the Jerry West biography because I wasn't as familiar with that story and his hardscrabble roots, all that stuff. But Michael Jordan, The Life, if you really are into this, go get the book. You will get so much background, so much detail. Roland's books are incredibly well written, but just nobody does research like him. Nobody gets the background like him. Nobody takes the... Nobody goes in depth like he does in his novels, which is, by the way, why I'm really excited now that you're working on Magic, who is, like I said, I was the 10-year-old kid on the St. Paul's Lutheran School playground in North Hollywood trying to make behind-the-back passes, man. I was a 10-year-old kid. They were not very good. I could not whip that ball around behind my back yet. I'm not sure I ever got really good at it, but to this day, I wanted to pass like him. I wanted to see the court like him. And I wanted to be him in so many, like a lot of kids growing up in LA, I wanted to be him in so many ways. So I cannot wait until that book is out, Roland.
Thank you for those kind words. Magic lit up a generation. I want to thank you for making all of this effort to interview me. And
come on.
I look forward to the day, Kurt, where we can have a beer after a game.
You and me both, man. I actually haven't seen you in person. What was it, Charlotte, or was it after you were out here in LA after Book Soup? It was one of those two. I think Charlotte was the last time.
Yeah, Charlotte was the last. We really got a chance to sit down and visit when I was in LA after
you and your lovely wife. Yeah,
all the media tour for my Kobe book.
So, I look forward to it, my friend. Next time, I look forward to one of these, like I said, getting to games, getting to something, and I owe you a beer or four.
No, just the opposite. Good thing those beers in the media lounge are free, so
drink. You know what we need to do then is get together in Portland or someplace that at least puts the good beer out. It's not just the Bud Light stuff. So
I agree. I'm
ready. All right. Thank you so much, buddy. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back next week with more of the Pro Basketball Talk podcast here at NBC Sports.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.